Hello and welcome to Focus on Business. I'm your host, Lee Strickland. Here's a reminder that the comments, views, and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily and usually represent the opinions of WCOM, its board, and its underwriters. My guests today are returning guests, Jim Verdonik and Benji Jones of Ward & Smith. Both are experts in crowdfunding, and today they're here to talk with us about crowdfunding blockchains, coins, and they're going to get us up to date on just what are these concepts and what's this new technology that's coming into place. And let me remind you a little bit of their backgrounds. They're both thought leaders in our community on crowdfunding and blockchains and coins. They are involved with the Raleigh Blockchain Working Group of E4 Carolinas, which is a networking group for new energy businesses. They represent venture capital funds, public and private portfolio companies, and other growth businesses in financing, M&A, licensing, and other transactions across a wide range of industries, including technology and bioscience. Both play pivotal roles in the passage of the North Carolina's Intrastate Crowdfunding, or NC PACES Act, and are building a statewide online capital raising ecosystem. Jim has written multiple books about finance and growing technology businesses, including Crowdfunding, A Legal Guide to Investment and Platform Regulation, and Crowdfunding Opportunities and Challenges. Both books analyze crowdfunding business practice and technology and the impact on the Jobs Act and the venture capital industry and traditional securities laws, which include the Securities Act of 1933, the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, the Investment Company Act of 1940, and the Investment Advisors Act of 1940. If you'll recall, when Benji was on the show, she's been on a couple times this year. Benji is a professor at Campbell University School of Law. She is also a speaker frequently in our area talking about crowdfunding and how it impacts our business community and the opportunities there. And she's been doing an iFund Women crowdfunding initiative on her own and has lots of insights to share with us on how it is to sit on both sides of the table in crowdfunding. And I want to thank them both for being on the program today.
Thanks for having us.
Well, let's just start. Let's give a basic refresher on what crowdfunding is, and then explain what blockchain crowdfunding is, what coins are, and why we care about it now in this new innovation.
Benji, why don't you handle what crowdfunding is?
So crowdfunding is basically using technology, and usually we use the internet, to reach a large number of people to raise money to support an enterprise or a person or an idea. And there's a couple of different kinds of crowdfunding. We kind of think about it in two categories. One is donations or rewards crowdfunding, which is what you do on Kickstarter or Indiegogo or GoFundMe, where you give a company or a person a contribution in exchange for a really good feeling because you like them, or pre-selling a product or service. Or there's the newest kind of crowdfunding, which is investment crowdfunding. Some people call it equity crowdfunding, which is where you use the internet to raise capital through the issuance and sale of a security in a company to raise money for the business to grow and prosper.
And so now we're overlaying that crowdfunding concept with a new technology platform, correct? That's what blockchain is?
Yeah, so blockchain, and people kind of intermix blockchain and coins or tokens, and they are related, but they're not exactly the same. So, and you can't understand why people would invest in coins and tokens that are essentially currency that people manufacture digitally unless you kind of understand the underlying technology.
So when we're talking about coins, conceptually for the audience, it would be like creating Bitcoins, but it's not Bitcoins, it's some other.
Bitcoin is a category of coin that is related to blockchain, okay? So basically, all this comes in under the concept legally of fintech. So both crowdfunding and coins and blockchain are all kind of subcategories of fintech. So Benji and I have had to expand our definition of what we do to include fintech with this. But basically, understanding the software, it's really kind of a type of ledger or record of events or transactions that the software keeps. And it it keeps it in a special way that's different than other types of software. So Equifax, we all remember Equifax, and probably, I know my wife spent half a week on the telephone trying to freeze our accounts. Equifax is the example of what happens when you store very important information and records without blockchain.
Right.
Okay, you store it in one place, which makes it a target for people to come in and steal it out of that one place.
Or alter it.
Or alter it.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
You can change it, and maybe you get a record that's been changed, and maybe you can prove. It's difficult to prove sometimes that what has been changed and what is not. So basically, blockchain takes the opposite approach of being centralized. It's a distributed P2P network of computers, and the work by the computers to store and verify the information is done by consensus. So if a typical blockchain scenario would be when 51% of the computing power in the system verify a set of facts, then that is approved to go on to the common ledger and database that's stored by all the computers in the whole system. And there may be hundreds of computers in the system.
So it's sequential. Each layer of information comes in, the computers, the users, the P2Ps have to verify that transaction occurred as it's specified. That block of information gets attached to the chain. And then once that's happened, it's pretty much verified. And once it gets buried in that chain, it can't be altered.
Yeah, so the key is a block. And you can tell by the way the blocks are chained together if somebody takes out a block and substitutes another block for them. There have been instances where the chains that temporarily will diverge from one another, and computers will disagree about what blocks should be in the chain and what not, but those are usually rectified on a same-day basis. Of course, attackers are continually attacking the blockchain. So they're looking for weaknesses where information can be altered and then used in very, very quickly. But it's generally deemed to be a lot more secure than our current system of storing everything in one place and then trying to guard that one place.
Well, and it's so again for the listeners. So if we're talking about information, as my business has its own ledgers, it's usually think of it as our accounting records. I made a sale. What my ledgers say are not the same things that maybe my client ledger says. Or with a blockchain, we're on the same ledger, and that transaction is getting recorded in the same block, and so we're reading the same file.
Yeah, so when I was growing up, I didn't really realize I was living in a world where everything is just on a big ledger. That wasn't the way my parents explained the world to me. But basically, ledgers and records turn out to be a whole lot more important than little Jimmy realized growing up. Essentially, our world runs on boring ledgers and records, all connected by the internet. And so, since we know lots of people don't live in small towns, just proving who you are,
yeah,
and where you were born, citizenship, and the like, somebody goes to a ledger. Okay, it happens to be a very inefficient ledger to go and find Jim's birth certificate in Brooklyn, New York. Same thing with college degrees. We all have, we'll say from here, there, and everywhere. But if you're a recruiter and you have to go verify whether somebody has a degree they say that they have, it can be a very time inefficient process. The concept of blockchain is it's going to make all that information very available for people to see who have permission to see it, but it's easier to see and harder to change. Same thing with money in the bank. How do you know if you're doing a transaction that you have money in the bank? The bank has one thing. You've got your little checkbook or your little digital checkbook and the like. There's lots of things where knowing that something is in fact true is extremely important. A lot of the things we talk about, where Jim was born, that doesn't change, okay? So there's not a whole lot of urgency in making that more efficient because people don't go and check that very often because it's a static thing and they tend to believe me. But if you have things like trading stock or credit card transactions where things are happening in nanoseconds, hundreds of millions of transactions, then creating efficiency in the system as well as security is a very useful concept. And that's what blockchain is primarily about, efficiency. It's also about getting rid of middlemen, okay? So there are lots, and middle women. It's not only middle men who are going to be unemployed, all you middle women out there are going to be unemployed too.
Middle people.
Yeah. Benji, you want to comment on any of that?
As the middle person in this conversation, why don't we keep going about how the middlemen are getting wiped away? And it has to do with the fact that the people who control the data, who check whether or not it's accurate, their job will become obsolete because the system itself is checking it and verifying.
Well, and so let's think about that again from the small business perspective and what we do in our normal day. You were talking about bank accounts. Well, we do credit card transactions. We have our bank statements. We have our QuickBooks ledgers. Those come in. We have to reconcile and say what the bank says we did is what we did, and the check that the customer paid actually cleared. And that's all that manual process that we spend our time. It's necessary to do, but it's really not productive when you think of that time could be spent doing something else if you didn't have to do those verification processes.
Yeah, and when we started out talking about fintech, but I don't want to leave the impression that this is just for bank transactions and the like. We use proving who you are and your ability or power to do something is very important. It's very important in our world. We have to prove our digital identities all the time. We have to prove what we own. Real estate. Right now, we're still using a system that was developed when America was a bunch of colonies. People go down to the courthouse and they look at deeds every time a piece of property transfers. If that's put on a blockchain where people have access to it instantly, it creates lots of efficiencies in the government. In the healthcare industry, people are constantly accessing data. People talk about internet voting. I'm not necessarily the biggest fan of that. I kind of like going down to the voting booth I don't even vote in advance. I go down to the voting booth and see my neighbors and we wave to each other at 6 o'clock in the morning or whatever. But if you were to do internet voting, the most secure way to do it would be via a blockchain. You know, right here we're in Carrboro, and we know that Carrboro is a really kind of green kind of town. So I'm going to give you Carrboites. Is it Carboites or Carbonians? What are you people?
Let's call them Carboites.
Carboites, okay. Well, you Carboites. Here's a really cool application for blockchain. So electric cars, we all know that they go and hook into the grid system and they take a little while to store, to rev up so you can ride around. If you think of electric car not just as a piece of transportation, but as a battery, and that's the biggest innovation in the electric car
right.
industry is the battery. It's really a means of storing electricity. So if you decided that you wanted to make a profit from your electric car, you could in the future charge it when utility rates are low, and then release your energy back into the system through your garage or wherever you store it at a time when electricity rates are high. And so you could be making an arbitrage profit based on conscious decisions to use your green vehicle, which will totally vindicate the Carboite philosophy.
I mean, it's good to think of it. The transactions that are important that we think of are protecting our assets, so our personal property, the transfer. And we frequently see records, and I love our government, but however, when they change systems and you suddenly get your tax bill for the year and your name is spelled completely incorrect because whoever keyed it in, to move that transaction from one system to the other has now done something, or your house went from being a three-story, 2,500 square foot house, and when they did something, it now is listed as a one-story, 1,500 square foot house. And you're looking at those records because they're subject to human error and there is no validation process when somebody's just moving a record here or there because there's not a third check. Where a blockchain is, like you said, once that property's in there, once it's set up in a certain way and we're obeying those rules, I'm not going to lose two stories and 1,000 feet off of my tax record for my house because that record is there permanently, and it's just transferring it to the new owner.
Yeah, and it's about efficiency, and it's kind of interesting. I had this debate with one of my partners, Bob Meeks, who's in our intellectual property group, and he's a software engineer, and I'm not. I'm a financial engineer. But basically, you know, I said, Bob, I'm reading all the stuff on the internet about how efficient this is, but what you're telling me is that you've got more than one computer doing the same job, okay?
Yep.
Hundreds of computers doing exactly the same thing. How
huge
is that efficient?
Of computing, you know, power.
And then how do they do it? They go back essentially and they verify a piece of property that's been owned in a chain since colonial times. So they're processing way more data than not just looking at the last bit of information. You know, and so how is that, how in the world can doing all that extra processing be more efficient? But it comes down to a trade-off between a little bit more expense on computing power versus taking people out of the system, not having to go down the courthouse to do it,
right.
Taking all kinds of other efficiencies that outweigh the incremental cost of computing power, which is very cheap.
Yeah, and it's not like we're, okay, I always show my age when I say this. We're not dealing with the mainframe computers that when I was back in college took up an entire floor of the university versus my Mac that probably has the same computing power setting on my desk. We have such more power in the technology and the computing that is constantly getting more and more powerful that allows us to go over these chains of information and do that validation and make sure things aren't moving.
Yeah, so that's a good point. What computers are doing this? So that kind of goes into, and why would somebody dedicate their computer? Well, you can earn coin, okay? And the most famous coin in the world that everybody knows is Bitcoin. And Bitcoin is based on the premise that if you reward people for devoting their computing power to servicing the blockchain and providing all the security and information for us, that people will dedicate their computing systems to that. So what you have, these computer, they're really computing farms that are, they're actually called miners. So they're mining coin, kind of like a gold miner was mining coin back in 1849. You know, you have people and corporations investing large amounts of money to fill rooms with servers that are performing these tasks. And every time they perform a task successfully, they earn a little
cha-ching
bit of coin. Cha-ching to them.
Right.
And they think that they can make money on that. And when they're not mining, they can use those assets for other purposes. Obviously, you know, depending on where you are, you know, there are off hours for different businesses. You can turn that into a profit center and help save the world from hackers.
Well, it's distributing the compute. I mean, it's not one group providing the computers. It's millions of computers scattered, distributed network over different places that are engaged in providing the computing power then.
Yeah.
I mean, then that's what gets you to saying you need 51% of the computers that are authorized to agree that this is the real transaction.
Right. And instead of somebody being able to hack from their basement on their little PC and everything, they'd have to buy a computing farm to kind of overpower the defense that's defending the blockchain. And most hackers don't have the same resources.
Well, I read something when I was studying up on this, is that by the time a block is about 10 blocks back in the chain, it can't be altered. So from that standpoint, because it's embedded in that chain, that information becomes more protected. Right or wrong, that information, if it's once it's been accepted, is the record and isn't able to be altered other than putting another block in somewhere else that says this is the correct information. That block back here never gets altered. It's there forever and ever, amen, when it's in that blockchain.
That's the beauty of it, and obviously
if
garbage in, garbage out is the old saying. So, having one person doing keystrokes on a computer, it can create problems in terms of inaccuracies. But having lots of computers doing the same thing minimizes that.
And so today we're talking about using that technology, those blockchains, in fintech into funding your business, creating your own currency. How does that mesh together? What is that, and why is that? And why is a small business or a startup, a spin out of one of the universities, why am I going to be excited about this new application of the technology?
Okay. So, Benji, you want to, we're getting a little bit into the finance side.
So, if you are building a business based off of blockchain, then there's the potential for you to create a system that builds value through what it takes to access and be a part of the chain.
So it's controlling the chain.
So you're controlling the chain, and you're controlling the universe of perhaps the currency that it takes to get into the chain. And so if you create a system and say you need these golden tickets to get into the system,
right,
and since those golden tickets are limited, as the value we create through the system becomes more valuable, the value of the golden ticket you hold will become a commodity that someone wants to buy from you, ideally at a higher price.
So let's relate it to something that we everybody or may not be. When we think of taxi services in New York City and the medallion that has to be on the taxi, the value of that medallion is it lets you into the system and says you're legally able to be a taxi and make your living from this. If you don't have the medallion, you don't get to play. And that's essentially what this is.
Unless you drive Uber.
Well, yeah, that's a whole.
Yeah, but and the magic is that there's a limited number of medallions.
Right.
So if we're all out of medallions and you want to become a taxi driver, then you have to go buy a medallion and to get into
right.
the system, and someone has to sell you that medallion, and theoretically, they will make a profit if there's no more medallions left
right.
to sell.
Now
you're in my world of expertise, because
yes.
I used to drive a cab in New York
in
the 1970s, and when I actually thought about taking the money I was going to go to law school with and buying a medallion, and for a while I would have been ahead. I think I eventually kind of recovered my loss becoming a lawyer. But it was essentially in the 1970s, this is a good example,
yeah.
it would have cost me $65,000 to buy a medallion. I kind of kept track of the market from North Carolina as a lawyer here, and medallions got up close to the $1 million mark, okay? But then Uber came along,
right.
and
Shift
now and then the value plummeted. You know, so when you're buying a monopoly, which a medallion is, it's a right to do something, a license to do something, and you're promised an exclusive right, and then that right ceases to become exclusive, then you can lose the whole value of it, and people who are investing in coins or speculating in coins, depending on your point of view, are kind of making a bet that the coins will be scarce and will rise in value over time. And sometimes that happens and sometimes it doesn't.
So going back is then, so when we're talking about I create this currency, the Lee coin, and I'm doing it for my business, there's a limited number of them. We're doing this. Am I subject to somebody else over here creating the Jim coin or the Benji coin, and I have to worry about what Uber did to the taxis in that they shift because I'm not creating the value that they want, or are they locked into my blockchain?
It kind of depends.
Okay.
It depends on if the actual product or service that you're selling is competitive.
Okay.
Right? So the example of Uber.
Right.
Right? So that hurts the medallion services, the taxi services,
right.
and the value goes down because you actually have competition in the product and
right.
sale. The other kind of competition would be is if your system allows a different type of currency to enter the system. So some people using blockchains create their own coin,
right.
exclusive for the chain. Some people create a blockchain that uses Bitcoin.
Right.
Some people create a blockchain that uses their own coin, Bitcoin, and other currencies. So it's kind of a mixed bag
okay.
of how the value of the Lee coin might get diluted because other currencies are coming into the mix. And I think it's also important to understand we call these currencies, but there is a bit of speculation involved in it, and it's the concept here is that currencies in our world are regulated. There's regulations placed on the currency.
You're hitting right where in my next question.
And so the big question that has surrounded cryptocurrencies, which is what they're called, they're hidden currency, is are they regulated? And the answer is so far they haven't been.
Right.
And so what you're seeing across the world is different countries addressing the lack of regulation of this speculative market in different ways. Fundamentally, the way we're seeing it happening in the United States is the assessment of these coin offerings as whether or not they are a security instrument.
Okay.
Right?
I'd just like to jump in before we get into the regulatory side, because there's one really cool application to this that's even more cool than the electric car. Okay.
Okay.
And that is, and everybody's going to love this. Okay. It's going to put lawyers out of business. Okay. So one of the uses of blockchain is to create smart contracts, and smart contracts are basically a contract that is self-executing, where the software says, if you do this, then I will cause X, Y, and Z to happen. And once that happens, the transaction happens automatically. So somebody can't go to court to stop it. They hiring a fancy lawyer is not going to do much good.
Because you met the criteria for it to be an executed
exactly.
contract.
And in the olden days, you know, there used to be things called letters of credit. It's about the best analogy you can get. And when I first became a lawyer, people were still using letters of credit for international transactions. Yeah. Now things that's too slow. That's too slow a system. But essentially, what a blockchain will do, and it will automatically transfer a coin upon occurrence of certain events. And when you enter into the contract, the blockchain will verify that your counterparty, somebody who's going to buy something for you, they actually have the coins in their account. And once that happens, then they're not allowed to transfer the coins out of their account until the transaction happens. So it enables you to have trust that the people you're dealing with, one, have the ability to fulfill the transaction, and two, that they won't change their minds on you where you deliver and they won't pay you. What this does is that Benji and I often have to advise clients that, yes, their contract was breached, but it's going to cost them $100,000 to enforce the contract. Oh, and by the way, you won't even get into court for a year.
Right.
Okay. And so people sometimes use the expense of litigation and the time and everything to blackmail other people into settling for less than they're going to do. So the computers will execute swift justice. And all you folks out there who don't like us rich lawyers and want us to be unemployed, well, this is your ticket there.
The middlemen and the lawyers are unemployed.
Exactly.
So one of the things I think for the listeners, relate it back to the days when everybody was writing physical checks, right? Not the electronic checks, but someone would write a check and you would call the bank, literally on the phone, call them and say, is there sufficient money in this account to cover this check? They would say yes. Well, that presumed at that moment in time that answer was yes.
Mm-hmm.
But if another check cleared after you hung up, that answer was no longer valid because it was that slow process of then, I mean, you literally wanted to run across the street and get the check processed if they said there was money in the account. And so that's what that's eliminated. We don't have that lag time. Somebody can't write two checks almost simultaneously for the same amount, say $1,000 each, and only have $1,000 of coin. That currency has to be there, and it's going to be held for that transaction to complete once all the criteria has met. And so they can't bounce a check. They can't kite a check.
A lot of time and money is spent preventing the dual usage of the same coin, and a lot of money is spent by other people trying to get dual usage of the same coin. And it's a constant battle, and then everybody is investing in more and more computing power to see who's going to win that battle.
Well, I always said if everybody worked as hard at being honest and innovative as they do at trying to circumvent and do things like that, imagine what the world would be. So gaming the system and trying to eliminate. But with this sequencing, we create this coin, and the value behind the coin is what the market says that coin represents.
I'm nodding my head.
Let's be perfectly honest.
Where is the value? It's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, because someone believes that value in the possibility in the future.
Same thing with a stock, a bond, or anything else. This is essentially a security. It just is going by a different name.
Benji and I used to do deals, mergers, back in the dot-com boom, where one CEO would say, basically, I'll pretend your company is worth $1 billion and buy it for $1 billion. If you pretend my company is worth $10 billion and accept that valuation on the stock, you're going to get. So, yeah, we all know what happened at the turn of the century.
Dot boom to dot bomb.
That's right. And, you know, and a lot of people think that there's going to be a coin boom and that will turn into a coin bust. We'll see what happens.
But it's kind of like looking, and again, I'll show my age. I remember being in 1984 in my first finance class in undergrad, and the stock market was basically ready to break 900. And my professor saying, is it ever going to break 1,000? I was like, well, that's a dumb question, because, you know, the value of the currency being exchanged is going to change over time. So just that alone would drive it over 1,000. And now we're looking at, we're 23,500 roughly as of the time we're doing this. And so understanding that what drove the value of that is the perceived value of what each of those companies, their stock is representing that. So what is that value? Whatever the customer is, whatever the profit is, whatever the dividend is, whatever the future earnings are. And that's what these coins are then going to represent in these fintech transactions. It's what we convince them the Lee coin is going to be worth based on who my customer is, my profitability, the access to transactions, the competition, that value that's created.
Well, yes and no.
Okay.
You know, yes, in theory, and over time, probably. But if you look at gold,
right.
Okay, you know, gold doesn't really produce earnings. It sits there. It actually costs to store gold and everything. And people invest in gold.
But it's really pretty.
Based upon, it does have a utility
for
jewelers and the like, but the cost of gold is driven by what people think the future cost of gold is going to be. And there's a big debate, and we were talking about, we're going to get into the regulatory side, and what is really driving the debate about regulation is, are these coins more like stock, or are they more like gold, where the value is simply in its scarcity and the idea that somebody will pay more money for it later on or pay less money for it later on, as opposed to producing something that you can eat or drive a car with?
So, it is a scarcity. Something. It's like diamonds are precious gems, but diamonds aren't really scarce. It's the controlled access. Mm-hmm. And those kind of things, and then the quality of the diamond, those kind of things. So whatever we impute the value to be, and we perceive the value to be for holding our wealth or holding the opportunity to transact, that as a person willing to do coins or whatever this is what I think is driving that process of somebody being willing to do a coin transaction.
And it's a very good example of that. So if we deal with regular currencies, okay, or stock that are traded, shares of stock that are traded worldwide, the price is kind of uniform. It fluctuates through the day and market, and there are people, arbitrageurs, who will look at very small discrepancies between the market prices and try to capitalize on that. But it's essentially a unified market worldwide in both major stocks and world currencies. However, Bitcoin is somewhat different. So the price of a Bitcoin in China is substantially higher than in the United States. That's because there are still people in the United States who trust the American government that they're not going to take away their coin, or they're not going to overinflate and the like. There are fewer of those people in China. You can't take Chinese, if you're a Chinese citizen, you can't be exporting most of your assets outside the country.
Right,
it's all locked up. So the utility of having a currency that is truly transferable and that the government does not control is worth more in China than it is worth in America. And God help us when we ever come to the day when the reverse is true, because we'll all be up Schitt's Creek.
But you think about it from that standpoint, because I was thinking for years my neighbors would go back to India once a year to take out that minimum amount that they could take out, or maximum amount that they could take out, to bring their money out of the country, because they're, you know, and you physically had to go and you had to do those transactions. But this day and age, what stops them from going over, hitting a computer in India, doing a Bitcoin transaction, and coming back and converting it, right? And that's essentially, I mean, let's think about it. We're doing money laundering with Bitcoin. There's all of these transactions that are occurring because the government isn't regulating, can't really monitor, don't know where it comes from. And so it is me trusting Jim or me trusting Benji on that platform versus me trusting the Chinese government or the Indian government or the U.S. government to give me a value in a currency.
Yeah, governments, generally speaking, don't like Bitcoin. Some governments put up with it, and they just outlawed coin exchanges in China. So they're trying to get kind of put the genie back into the bottle. People in China will still be able to trade coin on international exchanges, but that requires the internet, and the Chinese government also controls access to what information goes in and out of China.
If you can't control the wealth of your country through the currency, you start losing control of the transactions.
Yeah.
And that's the concern for them.
Yeah, and you get these horrible ideas that people control their own lives.
Yeah, I mean, imagine that.
Sorry, I'm a libertarian. You forced it out of me.
But I was getting an inkling of that.
But I think we're also featuring how the coin is like a currency.
Yeah.
And in that discussion, we're using a coin or a type of coin as a currency in lots of different worlds.
Yeah.
In lots of different blockchains.
Lots of different transactions.
Lots of different kinds of transaction. It becomes a currency that is, we can use for good,
mm-hmm.
or we can use for bad. And so that's when it's more like gold.
Right.
When the Bitcoin is sold in a way that is tied directly to a business, which is what is really what people are doing with these ICOs,
right.
These initial coin offerings, is where the question becomes, is that token, which is
right.
what coins are also called, we never can have one word for
right.
one thing.
It'd be
that
too simple.
Token, so, and the value of that token so tied to the blockchain world that it's being built around, that it becomes more like a share or an ownership interest in that blockchain universe. And so now we are exited the world of currency and moved into the world of
securities.
And I will tell you that Jim and I will never, at least in the next 5 to 10 years, tell you where that line is, because the line it's very, very hard to understand. And the more you can, and the regulators, because they want to be able to put walls around this, will grab more. If we're not sure whether or not it's a security,
it is.
It's going to be, you need to treat it as such, because the risk of it being treated as a security and you didn't do it appropriately is high. So right now, someone says, we're thinking about doing, creating this coin currency and it's not a security, we'll probably go,
you're going to err on the form of a security. But it almost sounds like how widely it's accepted, how widely it's transacted will start driving the definition, because it's like a privately held security versus a publicly traded security versus a transactional coin versus a Bitcoin worldwide exchanging. And you can start seeing like some of the features that would say, if it's this,
it's like a currency.
It's like a currency.
If it's this, it's more like a security. My answer to that is I'm with you, Lee, but I look at Jim and he may shake his head, because
we're being logical.
Well, it's it's also it's a very challenging world to hold on to. It's taken me a while to really understand. Like, I think we as humans have a hard time of separating the idea that this blockchain is not being controlled by people, that it is a software system.
It's an algorithm driven.
It's a system that's driven automatically, and there's really no, the check is across computers that are all working on the same problem at the same time to reach the same answer, as opposed to five people sitting in chairs and agreeing that,
right,
you know, we're looking at something that's colored black.
So an initial coin offering means that we're going to offer the car coin and we're going to go out and we're going to offer 1,000 of those, 1,000,000 of those, and a value is going to be put on those, and I'm going to hand that token or that coin to you, and it may be one worth 1,000 or it may be 1,000 worth one. It just, again, depends on how we've defined that ICO, that initial coin offering.
Yeah, the first of all, let's talk about terminology. There's kind of a movement afoot to minimize the word coin, because the regulators tend to identify coin as security. So the movement is to start calling things more tokens. Okay.
So it should be an ITO.
An ITO, yes. Token. And so but here is kind of being ex-New Yorker and everything, you take a token and you put it in a slot when they still had slots and metal tokens, okay? And you would get on the subway.
Right.
Okay. Or you could take a token at Horn and Hardux, the automat, and stick it in a slot, and you get a piece of pie or something. So token is being identified as something that it stresses the utility of a service that you're buying.
Convenience.
Okay. Okay. And the idea is that the more it is like that, then the less it is like a security. And the word coin is being used to say, well, okay, those are those bad coins that are securities. We're the good guys who are tokens. Now, how much the regulators pay attention to that? But I'll tell you that to this, this is appearing now in articles written by lawyers on the internet. And we all know if lawyers write something on the internet, it must be true. Because first of all, a lawyer would never lie, and certainly not on the internet.
You're going to give a new definition to token effort, too.
Yes.
There.
Yeah.
It's taking something that we've had transactionally as tokens, bus tokens. There used to be bathroom tokens, to even use the bathroom stalls. There were tokens to get on the subway. I'm going to take my U.S. currency. I'm going to buy tokens for this system, and then those tokens, it's almost like stamps, too, from that matter. We can have a forever stamp that we could buy 10 million of them at 29 cents a number of years ago, and there's still tokens that are valid to put on our letters now to send out, even if they're 59 cents now for a forever stamp. So whenever we buy that token, it's still a token if we need to put it in for the bus, the subway, a stamp, whatever. But what we're saying is on the security end, the value of that token changes based on the value that's created in that blockchain and how many, how limited, how widely dispersed they're used, or how narrowly they're used.
Yeah. Stamps are another good analogy. I like that because, you know, I don't know what it costs to mail a letter.
I think it's 52 cents?
It's okay.
I just buy the
first. You go to the post
stamp,
office and you pay the government 52 cents, you'll get a stamp, and the government is promising that it will send somebody to carry that to somebody else, okay? On the other hand, my daughter growing up loved stamps.
Yeah.
Okay, and you could buy 100 of them for $1,
right.
Okay? Now, they're both stamps and everything, but if you put those on an envelope and everything, the government was not promising that it was going to do something for you. And so when you're looking at coins, it's kind of good to look at the same way. It can be or tokens or stamps. It's who is backing it, what are they promising to do,
and what's their ability to deliver.
And so whatever you call it is not going to define what it is, despite the efforts of people to cause that to happen.
And it's the existence of the need of the government to make the mail get delivered.
I wish they'd do that.
The third party. Right. That creates an enterprise that you're investing in.
Right.
Because if you buy the stamp and believe that the system will work, well, the system has to be built to make it work. And right. if I just by buying the stamp, I'm not actually building that system, right? And right. so whoever builds that system, by selling that stamp, you're selling. And if the stamp goes up in value,
right.
you're selling. I'm speculating by buying that stamp that it's going to have more value tomorrow.
Well, and
because you've built that system, and there is the world of the security that.
And
they're
so, and I'll pick on Amazon. Everybody knows Amazon. They have Amazon Prime. You get it in 2 days. They'll deliver on Sunday, and they'll use the post office to.
They're
deliver.
Moving to Carrboro, right? I heard that.
And so. When we're looking at that, we take that Prime membership that says if I order something on Friday, guaranteed delivery in 2 days, on Sunday, we get that product. We expect that promise that Amazon has made for that. We've exchanged value for that, and it's supposed to come on Sunday. They're using the United States Postal Service to deliver, and you get your little notice that says, oh, we attempted to deliver this on Sunday, but nobody was home or the business was closed. Well, I don't know how many of you all are the business. You're ordering something for at home for your to be delivered to your business. But it's a residence. There is no business. It was not closed. There's a gigantic mailbox out there. So our perception is Amazon is going to commit to this. But they're delivering and relying on somebody else's stamp, their token, to say yes. When Amazon buys that token, that stamp, to get it delivered on Sunday to keep the promise, the value starts becoming an issue when they have no control over that coin, that token, that stamp that the post office is now responsible for, right? And so it's kind of that way too. If I'm Amazon and I'm transacting in the U.S. Postal Service's stamps and delivery, I don't have control of that system other than to move to somebody else's coin, to somebody else's token, when you're not keeping your promise, right?
Yeah, and we talked about speculation versus investment. And basically, if you really look at this, in the past year or two, $3 billion, with a B, folks, right. has gone into buying coins, okay? Some of them from sponsors. In the securities world, we use the word issuer.
Right.
Because the issuer, it takes some of its own stock and issues it to a specific person. In the coin world, they're called sponsors. And really all it is somebody wrote what is called a white paper that says, if we got $100 million, we'd really like to build this system, and maybe someday this system would be really valuable and useful to people, and so people will know that intrinsically, and they will want to pay more money for our coins in the future. Those people could be three guys in a basement drinking beer, okay, who just happened to get in really early into the craze and everything and said, yeah, give us $100 million, we'll build you anything. What we're seeing now, I just talked with somebody that I really, really respect, and he's a business consultant. He's advised two companies through this process, and he said, basically, the days of free money in this thing are really over. Investors are kind of wising up, and they're not giving that on the promise that, oh, maybe we'll build something someday. They want to see a real business plan. They've talked about doing an escrow where the money is being divvied out in four pieces, and you have to prove to a group of wise men or wise women or wise asses that you have performed what you said you're going to perform before you get your next installment. So the SEC, by calling some of these things securities, are kind of bringing law and order to a market that was going crazy.
But and interesting, it is like the dot-com era is sort of a paradigm or the blueprint for, because money went out to those dot-coms where nobody ever, we have a concept that we need $52 million to create this piece of software before anybody ever saw that led to the dot bomb. So this is like, could very easily be following that same pattern, except what we're saying is the regulators will step in most likely because it's going to be deemed more of a securities transaction versus somebody sitting in their boxer shorts in their parents' basement, you know, cobbling something together and getting somebody to give them $52 million or $100 million. Yeah. There has to be proof of effort.
Yeah. And remember this, the primary thing about securities, there are lots of technical details about securities laws, but the prime directive is that you have to disclose material facts to people. People are free to then make stupid investments, but if you don't make the right disclosures, If things go wrong, then you can be held personally liable for that. And basically, a lot of these transactions were happening overseas. Okay, had somebody called me up and said basically, oh, find the best country in Europe to incorporate, and now the SEC is saying U.S. securities laws applied to U.S. offerings, we'll have a foreign offering, and had to explain to them that, no, you actually have to move your business overseas to be a foreign company in that context. So people are, that was a sign that people are starting to feel the box squeezing in, that the right. Free money is kind of going away. We're going to impose the same old rules, which you got to disclose to people. And yes, there is a group of people who are stupid enough to invest in things when you've told them this thing will never work. But there are other smarter money who, when the speculation goes out of the bubble, will say, I'm going to be more careful in what I do, and the value of what may have been the going rate last year, but the going rate just went down. And I think that's what's going to happen to the coins/token market.
So when we think about this, though, from the investor side, then, when an investor's out there and getting approached to participate in an ICO, what is their screening mechanism? What should they be thinking about? How are they going to go through the same? Should they go through the same process and need to see those security offerings documents or a business plan? Should they go through that same process even if it hasn't yet been deemed a coin or a token or a security?
Well, yeah. I mean, what are you doing with your money?
Right.
It's truly the question of how do you want to safeguard your own money? And irrespective of what big government says you are entitled to receive, what is the information that you want to receive before you give someone your hard-earned money is really the question to be asked. Right. Irrespective of if you think it is a 1,000% home run, then it can't hurt to look a little bit more at the information to make sure your understanding is accurate. It's protection. It's doing due diligence. It's your money. You should be protecting it.
So when we think about it, and we were talking about the different types of crowdfunding, how does the ICO fit in that crowdfunding structure?
What we'll tell people is that ICO needs to fit into a securities exemption, and whichever securities exemption you enter into to use crowdfunding as your tool will dictate how you can approach investors, what you have to tell investors, and how much investors can invest.
So from the intrastate exception.
Yes.
I'm going to squeeze this and we have just a few minutes. So from the intrastate NC PACES Act crowdfunding exemption, if we were only going for investors, all of our transactions, and we meet all of the requirements to be an intrastate offering, we could do an NC PACES Act ICO. I still want to say ITO, but initial coin offering. But we're going to go through all of the steps based on the amount we want to raise, all of those parameters. And so we just say, well, we're issuing coins
instead of
stock. Right.
That's conceptually, yes. Our regulators might look a little bit
in askance.
Yes, at an ICO under NC PACES. But yes, people are using regulation crowdfunding to do ICOs so that all investors across the country can get in. They're using Regulation A. The biggest exemption, which is not surprising, is Rule 506, okay, which is the same way we brought accredited investors into private placements. That's the biggest ICO market. So the ICO term is a little bit of a misnomer because it sounds like it's an initial public offering, but it's not. It's an exempt sale of a security, and it's just someone's calling it something cute.
Yeah. One of the really interesting things about decision making, you're talking about what information do investors want. There have been lots of psychological studies about consumer behavior that applies to investor behavior. So, for example, if somebody goes into a store and has to pay cash, they are much more likely to kick the goods around and really say, do I really want to buy this and everything, as opposed to using a credit card. Okay. Same thing is really applying here. there's all the value of Bitcoin and Ethereum and other non-utilitarian tokens, true coins, a currency, about $150 billion, maybe $200 billion at this point, okay? One wonders whether that is treated the same as cash in people's minds, or is kind of like, what can I do with this?
Monopoly money.
Yeah, it's monopoly money. And so in these offerings, what they're structured, what happened when you do an ICO, a sponsor does a utilitarian ICO to raise money for their particular business, a lot of times they're not being paid by investors in dollars, they're being paid in other coin. And those investors, because it is a coin, may have a psychological predisposition not to be quite as careful as if they were taking money out of their 401k account.
Right. Because it is that psychological thing. It's easy to swipe the credit card and think about, I'll go home and I'll look at my budget later, versus if I have to count out the dollar bills and scramble around for real coins to pay whatever that little indulgent I am impulsively buying at the store. So yeah, it's easier to go on Amazon, charge it to your card and stuff and not pay attention. I would think the same psychological factors are probably there for doing this too. I want to thank you both. Believe it or not, we're at the end of the hour. I want to thank you both for being here today. And everyone, until next time, stay focused on the important things.